would take place, and that in this world of everything there would also be a man with enough sloth to put up with her. For a long time already Amarantha had given up trying to make her into a useful woman. Since those forgotten afternoons, when her niece barely had enough interest to turn the crank on the sewing machine, she had reached the conclusion that she was simple-minded. "We're going to have to raffle you off," she would tell her, perplexed at the fact that men's words would not penetrate her. Later on, when Ursula insisted that Remedios the Beauty go to mass with her face covered with a shawl, Amarantha thought that a mysterious recourse like that would turn out to be so provoking that soon a man would come who would be intrigued enough to search out patiently for the weak point of her heart. But when she saw the stupid way in which she rejected a pretender, who, for many reasons, was more desirable than a prince, she gave up all hope. Fernanda did not even make any attempt to understand her. When she saw Remedios the Beauty dressed as a queen at the bloody carnival, she thought that she was an extraordinary creature. But when she saw her eating with her hands, incapable of giving an answer that was not a miracle of simple-mindedness, the only thing that she lamented was the fact that the idiots in the family lived so long. In spite of the fact that Colonel Aureliano Buendia kept on believing and repeating that Remedios the Beauty was, in reality, the most lucid being that he had ever known, and that she showed it at every moment with her startling ability to put things over on everyone, they let her go her own way. Remedios the Beauty stayed there, wandering through the desert of solitude, bearing no cross on her back, maturing in her dreams without nightmares, her interminable baths, her unscheduled meals, her deep and prolonged silences that had no memory, until one afternoon in March, when Fernando went to fold her Brabant sheets in the garden and asked the women in the house for help. She had just begun when Amarantha noticed that Remedios the Beauty was covered all over by an intense paleness. "Don't you feel well?" she asked her. Remedios the Beauty, who was clutching the sheet by the other end, gave a pitying smile. "Quite the opposite," she said. "I never felt better." She had just finished saying it when Fernanda felt a delicate wind of light pull the sheets out of her hands and open them up wide. Amarantha felt a mysterious trembling in the lace on her petticoats, and she tried to grasp the sheet so that she would not fall down at the instant in which Remedios the Beauty began to rise. Ursula, almost blind at the time, was the only person who was sufficiently calm to identify the nature of that determined wind, and she left the sheets to the mercy of the light as she watched Remedios the Beauty waving goodbye in the midst of the flapping sheets that rose up with her, abandoning with her the environment of beetles and dahlias, and passing through the air with her as 4 o'clock in the afternoon came to an end. And they were lost forever with her in the upper atmosphere, where not even the highest flying birds of memory could reach her. The outsiders, of course, thought that Remedios the Beauty had finally succumbed to her irrevocable fate of a queen bee, and that her family was trying to save her honour with that tale of levitation. Fernanda, burning with envy, finally accepted the miracle, and for a long time she kept on praying to God to send her back her sheets. Most people believed in the miracle, and they even lighted candles and celebrated novenas. Perhaps there might have been talk of nothing else for a long time if the barbarous extermination of the Aurelianos had not replaced amazement with horror. Although he had never thought of it as an omen, Colonel Aureliano Buendia had foreseen the tragic end of his sons in a certain way. When Aureliano Serrador and Aureliano Arcaya, the two who had arrived during the tumult, expressed a wish to stay in Macondo, their father tried to dissuade them. He could not understand what they were going to do in a town that had been transformed into a dangerous place overnight. But Aureliano Centeno and Aureliano Triste, backed by Aureliano Secundo, gave them work in their businesses. Colonel Aureliano Buendia had reasons that were still very confused and were against that determination. When he saw Mr. Brown in the first automobile to reach Macondo, an orange convertible with a horn that frightened the dogs with its bark, the old soldier grew indignant with the servile excitement of the people, and he realized that something had changed in the makeup of the men since the days when they would leave their wives and children and toss a shotgun on their shoulders to go off to war. The local authorities after the armistice of Neerlandia, were mayors without initiative, decorative judges picked from among the peaceful and tired conservatives of Macondo. "This is a regime of wretches," Colonel Aureliano Buendia would comment when he saw the barefoot policemen armed with wooden clubs pass. "We fought all those wars, and all of it just so that we didn't have to paint our houses blue." When the banana company arrived, however, the local functionaries were replaced by dictatorial foreigners, whom Mr. Brown brought to live in the electrified chicken yard, so that they could enjoy, as he explained it, the dignity that their status warranted, and so that they would not suffer from the heat and the mosquitoes and the countless discomforts and privations of the town. The old policemen were replaced by hired assassins with machetes. Shut up in his workshop, Colonel Aureliano Buendia thought about those changes, and for the first time in his quiet years of solitude, he was tormented by the definite certainty that it had been a mistake not to have continued the war to its final conclusion. During that time, a brother of the forgotten Colonel Magnifico Bispal was taking his 7-year-old grandson to get a soft drink at one of the pushcarts on the square, and because the child accidentally bumped into a corporal of police and spilled the drink on his uniform, the barbarian cut him to pieces with his machete, and with one stroke he cut off the head of the grandfather as he tried to stop him. The whole town saw the decapitated man pass by as a group of men carried him to his house, with a woman dragging the head along by its hair, and the bloody sack with the pieces of the child. For Colonel Aureliano Buendia it meant the limits of atonement. He suddenly found himself suffering from the same indignation that he had felt in his youth over the body of the woman who had been beaten to death because she had been bitten by a rabid dog. He looked at the groups of bystanders in front of the house, and with his old stentorian voice, restored by a deep disgust with himself, he unloaded upon them the burden of hate that he could no longer bear in his heart. "One of these days," he shouted, "I'm going to arm my boys so we can get rid of these shitty gringos." During the course of that week, at different places along the coast, his 17 sons were hunted down like rabbits by invisible criminals who aimed at the center of their crosses of ash. Aureliano Triste was leaving the house with his mother at 7 in the evening when a rifle shot came out of the darkness and perforated his forehead. Aureliano Centeno was found in the hammock that he was accustomed to hang up in the factory with an ice pick between his eyebrows driven in up to the handle. Aureliano Serrador had left his girlfriend at her parents' house after having taken her to the movies, and was returning through the well-lighted street of the Turks, when someone in the crowd, who was never identified, fired a revolver shot which knocked him over into a cauldron of boiling lard. A few minutes later, someone knocked at the door of the room where Aureliano Arcaya was shut up with a woman, and shouted to him, "Hurry up! They're killing your brothers!" The woman who was with him said later that Aureliano Arcaya jumped out of bed and opened the door, and was greeted with the discharge of a Mauser that split his head open. On that night of death, while the house was preparing to hold a wake for the four corpses, Fernanda ran through the town like a madwoman, looking for Aureliano Segundo, whom Petra Cotes had locked up in a closet, thinking that the order of extermination included all who bore the colonel's name. She would not let him out until the fourth day, when the telegrams received from different places along the coast made it clear that the fury of the invisible enemy was directed only at the brothers marked with the crosses of ash. Amaranta fetched the ledger where she had written down the facts about her nephews, and as the telegrams arrived, she drew lines through the names until only that of the eldest remained. They remembered him very well, because of the contrast between his dark skin and his green eyes. His name was Aureliano Amador, and he was a carpenter, living in a village hidden in the foothills. After waiting 2 weeks for the telegram telling of his death, Aureliano Segundo sent a messenger to him in order to warn him, thinking that he might not know about the threat that hung over him. The emissary returned with the news that Aureliano Amador was safe. The night of the extermination, 2 men had gone to get him at his house, and had shot at him with their revolvers, but they had missed the cross of ashes. Aureliano Amador had been able to leap over the wall of the courtyard, and was lost in the labyrinth of the mountains, which he knew like the back of his hand, thanks to the friendship he maintained with the Indians, from whom he bought wood. Nothing more was heard of him. Those were dark days for Colonel Aureliano Buendia. The President of the Republic sent him a telegram of condolence, in which he promised an exhaustive investigation and paid homage to the dead men. At his command, the mayor appeared at the services with 4 funeral wreaths, which he tried to place on the coffins, but the colonel ordered him into the street. After the burial, he drew up and personally submitted to the President of the Republic a violent telegram, which the telegrapher refused to send. Then he enriched it with terms of singular aggressiveness, put it in an envelope, and mailed it. As had happened with the death of his wife, as had happened to him so many times during the war with the deaths of his best friends, he did not have a feeling of sorrow, but a blind and directionless rage, a broad feeling of impotence. He even accused Father Antonio Isabel of complicity for having marked his sons with indelible ashes so that they could be identified by their enemies. The decrepit priest, who could no longer string ideas together, and who was beginning to startle his parishioners with the wild interpretations he gave from the pulpit, appeared one afternoon at the house with the goblet in which he had prepared the ashes that Wednesday, and he tried to anoint the whole family with them, to show that they could be washed off with water. But the horror of the misfortune had penetrated so deeply that not even Fernanda would let him experiment on her, and never again was Abuendia seen to kneel at the altar rail on Ash Wednesday. Colonel Aureliano Buendia did not recover his calm for a long time. He abandoned the manufacture of little fishes, ate with great difficulty, and wandered all through the house as if walking in his sleep, dragging his blanket and chewing on his quiet rage. At the end of 3 months his hair was ashen, his old waxed moustache poured down beside his colourless lips, but, on the other hand, his eyes were once more the burning coals that had startled those who had seen him born, and that in other days had made chairs rock with a simple glance. In the fury of his torment, he tried futilely to rouse the omens that had guided his youth along dangerous paths into the desolate wasteland of glory. He was lost, astray in a strange house, where nothing and no one now stirred in him the slightest vestige of affection. Once he opened Melquiades' room, looking for the traces of a past from before the war, and he found only rubble, trash, piles of waste accumulated over all the years of abandonment. Between the covers of the books that no one had ever read again, in the old parchments damaged by dampness, a livid flower had prospered, and in the air that had been the purest and brightest in the house, an unbearable smell of rotten memories floated. One morning he found Ursula weeping under the chestnut tree at the knees of her dead husband. Colonel Aureliano Buendia was the only inhabitant of the house who still did not see the powerful old man who had been beaten down by half a century in the open air. "Say hello to your father," Ursula told him. He stopped for an instant in front of the chestnut tree, and once again he saw that the empty space before him did not arouse an affection either. "What does he say?" he asked.
"He's very sad," Ursula answered, "because he thinks that you're going to die."
"Tell him," the colonel said, smiling, "that a person doesn't die when he should, but when he can." The omen of the dead father stirred up the last remnant of pride that was left in his heart, but he confused it with a sudden gust of strength. It was for that reason that he hounded Ursula to tell him where in the courtyard the gold coins that they had found inside the plaster St. Joseph were buried. "You'll never know," she told him with a firmness inspired by an old lesson. "One day," she added, "the owner of that fortune will appear, and only he can dig it up." No one knew why a man who had always been so generous had begun to covet money with such anxiety, and not the modest amounts that would have been enough to resolve an emergency, but a fortune of such mad size that the mere mention of it left Aureliano Segundo awash in amazement. His old fellow party members, to whom he went asking for help, hid so as not to receive him. It was around that time that he was heard to say, "The only difference today between liberals and conservatives is that the liberals go to mass at 5 o'clock and the conservatives at 8. Nevertheless, he insisted with such perseverance, begged in such a way, broke his code of dignity to such a degree, that with a little help from here and a little more from there, sneaking about everywhere, with a slippery diligence and a pitiless perseverance, he managed to put together in 8 months more money than Ursula had buried. Then he visited the ailing Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, so that he would help him start the total war. At a certain time, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez was really the only one who could have pulled, even from his paralytic's chair, the musty strings of rebellion. After the armistice of Neerlandia, while Colonel Aureliano Buendia took refuge with his little gold fishes, he kept in touch with the rebel officers who had been faithful to him until the defeat. With them he waged the sad war of daily humiliation, of entreaties and petitions, of come back tomorrow, of any time now, of we're studying your case with the proper attention. The war, hopelessly lost, against the many, yours most truly's, who should have signed, and would never sign, the lifetime pensions. The other war, the bloody one of 20 years, did not cause them as much damage as the corrosive war of eternal postponements. Even Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, who escaped 3 attempts on his life, survived 5 wounds, and emerged unscathed from innumerable battles, succumbed to that atrocious siege of waiting, and sank into the miserable defeat of old age, thinking of Amaranta among the diamond-shaped patches of light in a borrowed house. The last veterans of whom he had word had appeared photographed in a newspaper with their faces shamelessly raised beside an anonymous President of the Republic who gave them buttons with his likeness on them to wear in their lapels, and returned to them a flag soiled with blood and gunpowder, so that they could place it on their coffins. The others, more honourable, were still waiting for a letter in the shadow of public charity, dying of hunger, living through rage, rotting of old age amid the exquisite shit of glory, so that when Colonel Aureliano Buendia invited him to start a mortal conflagration that would wipe out all vestiges of a regime of corruption and scandal backed by the foreign invader, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez could not hold back a shudder of compassion. "Oh, Aureliano," he sighed, "I already knew that you were old, but now I realize that you're a lot older than you look." In the bewilderment of her last years, Ursula had had very little free time to attend to the papal education of José Arcadio, and the time came for him to get ready to leave for the seminary right away. Mimi, his sister, dividing her time between Fernanda's rigidity and Amaranta's bitterness, at almost the same moment reached the age set for her to be sent to the nuns' school, where they would make a virtuoso on the clavichord of her. Ursula felt tormented by grave doubts concerning the effectiveness of the methods with which she had moulded the spirit of the languid apprentice supreme pontiff, but she did not put the blame on her staggering old age, or the dark clouds that barely permitted her to make out the shape of things, but on something that she herself could not really define, and that she conceived confusedly as a progressive breakdown of time. "The years nowadays don't pass the way the old ones used to," she would say, feeling that everyday reality was slipping through her hands. In the past, she thought, children took a long time to grow up. All one had to do was remember all the time needed for José Arcadio, the elder, to go away with the gypsies, and all that happened before he came back, painted like a snake, and talking like an astronomer. And the things that happened in the house before Amaranta and Arcadio forgot the language of the Indians and learned Spanish. One had to see only the days of sun and dew that poor José Arcadio Buendia went through under the chestnut tree, and all the time needed to mourn his death before they brought in a dying Colonel Aureliano Buendia, who, after so much war and so much suffering from it, was still not 50 years of age. In other times, after spending the whole day making candy animals, she had more than enough time for the children to see from the whites of their eyes that they needed a dose of castor oil. Now, however, when she had nothing to do and would go about with José Arcadio riding on her hip from dawn to dusk, this bad kind of time compelled her to leave things half done. The truth was that Ursula resisted growing old, even when she had already lost count of her age, and she was a bother on all sides, as she tried to meddle in everything, and as she annoyed strangers with her questions as to whether they had left a plaster St. Joseph to be kept until the rains were over, during the days of the war. No one knew exactly when she had begun to lose her sight. Even in her later years, when she could no longer get out of bed, it seemed that she was simply defeated by decrepitude. But no one discovered that she was blind. She had noticed it before the birth of José Arcadio. At first she thought it was a matter of a passing debility, and she secretly took marrow syrup and put honey on her eyes. But quite soon she began to realize that she was irrevocably sinking into the darkness, to a point where she never had a clear notion of the invention of the electric light, for when they put in the first bulbs, she was only able to perceive the glow. She did not tell anyone about it, because it would have been a public recognition of her uselessness. She concentrated on a silent schooling in the distances of things and people's voices, so that she would still be able to see with her memory what the shadows of her cataracts no longer allowed her to. Later on, she was to discover the unforeseen help of odours, which were defined in the shadows with a strength that was much more convincing than that of bulk and colour, and which saved her finally from the shame of admitting defeat. In the darkness of the room, she was able to thread a needle and sew a buttonhole, and she knew when the milk was about to boil. She knew with so much certainty the location of everything that she herself forgot that she was blind at times. On one occasion, Fernanda had the whole house upset because she had lost her wedding ring, and Ursula found it on a shelf in the children's bedroom. Quite simply, while the others were going carelessly all about, she watched them with her four senses, so that they never took her by surprise, and after some time she discovered that every member of the family, without realizing it, repeated the same path every day, the same actions, and almost repeated the same words at the same hour. Only when they deviated from meticulous routine did they run the risk of losing something. So when she heard Fernanda all upset because she had lost her ring, Ursula remembered that the only thing different that she had done that day was to put the mattresses out in the sun, because Meme had found a bedbug the night before. Since the children had been present at the fumigation, Ursula figured that Fernanda had put the ring in the only place where they could not reach it, the shelf. Fernanda, on the other hand, looked for it in vain along the paths of her everyday itinerary, without knowing that the search for lost things is hindered by routine habits, and that is why it is so difficult to find them. The rearing of José Arcadio helped Ursula in the exhausting task of keeping herself up to date on the smallest changes in the house. When she realized that Amaranta was dressing the saints in the bedroom, she pretended to show the boy the differences in the colors. "Let's see," she would tell him. "Tell me what color the Archangel Raphael is wearing." In that way the child gave her the information that was denied her by her eyes, and long before he went away to the seminary, Ursula could already distinguish the different colors of the saints' clothing by the texture. Sometimes unforeseen accidents would happen. One afternoon, when Amaranta was embroidering on the porch with the begonias, Ursula bumped into her. "For heaven's sake," Amaranta protested, "watch where you're going." "It's your fault," Ursula said. "You're not sitting where you're supposed to." She was sure of it, but that day she began to realize something that no one had noticed, and it was that, with the passage of the year, the sun imperceptibly changed position, and those who sat on the porch had to change their position little by little without being aware of it. From then on, Ursula had only to remember the date in order to know exactly where Amaranta was sitting. Even though the trembling of her hands was more and more noticeable, and the weight of her feet was too much for her, her small figure was never seen in so many places at the same time. She was almost as diligent as when she had the whole weight of the house on her shoulders. Nevertheless, in the impenetrable solitude of decrepitude, she had such clairvoyance as she examined the most insignificant happenings in the family that for the first time she saw clearly the truths that her busy life in former times had prevented her from seeing. Around the time they were preparing José Arcadio for the seminary, she had already made a detailed recapitulation of life in the house since the founding of Macondo, and had completely changed the opinion that she had always held of her descendants. She realized that Colonel Aureliano Buendia had not lost his love for the family because he had been hardened by the war, as she had thought before, but that he had never loved anyone, not even his wife Remedios, or the countless one-night women who had passed through his life, and much less his sons. She sensed that he had fought so many wars not out of idealism, as everyone had thought, nor had he renounced a certain victory because of fatigue, as everyone had thought, but that he had won and lost for the same reason, pure and sinful pride. She reached the conclusion that the son for whom she would have given her life was simply a man incapable of love. One night, when she was carrying him in her belly, she heard him weeping. It was such a definite lament that José Arcadio Buendía woke up beside her and was happy with the idea that his son was going to be a ventriloquist. Other people predicted that he would be a prophet. She, on the other hand, shuddered from the certainty that the deep moan was a first indication of the fearful pigtail, and she begged God to let the child die in her womb. But the lucidity of her old age allowed her to see, and she said so many times, that the cries of children in their mother's wombs are not announcements of ventriloquism or a faculty for prophecy, but an unmistakable sign of an incapacity for love. The lowering of the image of her son brought out in her all at once all of the compassion that she owed him. Amaranta, however, whose hardness of heart frightened her, whose concentrated bitterness made her bitter, suddenly became clear to her in the final analysis as the most tender woman who had ever existed, and she understood with pitying clarity that the unjust tortures to which she had submitted Pietro Crespi had not been dictated by a desire for vengeance, as everyone had thought, nor had the slow martyrdom with which she had frustrated the life of Colonel Gerineldo Marquez been determined by the gall of her bitterness, as everyone had thought, but that both actions had been a mortal struggle between a measureless love and an invincible cowardice, and that the irrational fear that Amaranta had always had of her own tormented heart had triumphed in the end. It was during that time that Ursula began to speak Rebecca's name, bringing back the memory of her with an old love that was exalted by tardy repentance and a sudden admiration, coming to understand that only she, Rebecca, the one who had never fed of her milk, but only of the earth of the land and the whiteness of the walls, the one who did not carry the blood of her veins in hers, but the unknown blood of the strangers whose bones were still clocking in their grave, Rebecca, the one with an impatient heart, the one with a fierce womb, was the only one who had the unbridled courage that Ursula had wanted for her line. "Rebecca," she would say, feeling along the walls, "how unfair we've been to you." In the house, they simply thought that her mind was wandering, especially since the time she had begun walking about with her right arm raised like the Archangel Gabriel. Fernanda, however, realized that there was a sun of clairvoyance in the shadows of that wandering, for Ursula could say, without hesitation, how much money had been spent in the house during the previous year. Amaranta had a similar idea one day, as her mother was stirring a pot of soup in the kitchen, and said all at once, without knowing that they were listening to her, that the corn grinder they had bought from the first gypsies, and that had disappeared during the time before José Arcadio had taken his 65 trips around the world, was still in Pilar Ternera's house. Also, almost 100 years old, but fit and agile in spite of her inconceivable fatness, which frightened children as her laughter had frightened the doves in other times, Pilar Ternera was not surprised that Ursula was correct, because her own experience was beginning to tell her that an alert old age can be more keen than the cards. Nevertheless, when Ursula realized that she had not had enough time to consolidate the vocation of José Arcadio, she let herself be disturbed by consternation. She began to make mistakes, trying to see with her eyes the things that intuition allowed her to see with greater clarity. One morning she poured the contents of an inkwell over the boy's head, thinking that it was rose water. She stumbled so much in her insistence in taking part in everything that she felt herself upset by gusts of bad humour, and she tried to get rid of the shadows that were beginning to wrap her in a straitjacket of cobwebs. It was then that it occurred to her that her clumsiness was not the first victory of decrepitude and darkness, but a sentence passed by time. She thought that previously, when God did not make the same traps out of the months and years that the Turks used when they measured a yard of percale, things were different. Now children not only grew faster, but even feelings developed in a different way. No sooner had Remedios the Beauty ascended to heaven in body and soul than the inconsiderate Fernanda was going about mumbling to herself because her sheets had been carried off. The bodies of the Aurelianos were no sooner cold in their graves than Aureliano II had the house lighted up again, filled with drunkards playing the accordion and dousing themselves in champagne, as if dogs and not Christians had died, and as if that madhouse, which had cost her so many headaches and so many candy animals, was destined to become a trash heap of perdition. Remembering those things as she prepared José Arcadio's trunk, Ursula wondered if it was not preferable to lie down once and for all in her grave and let them throw the earth over her. And she asked God, without fear, if he really believed that people were made of iron in order to bear so many troubles and mortifications. And asking over and over, she was stirring up her own confusion, and she felt irrepressible desires to let herself go and scamper about like a foreigner, and allow herself, at last, an instant of rebellion, that instant yearned for so many times, and so many times postponed, putting her resignation aside, and shitting on everything once and for all, and drawing out of her heart the infinite stacks of bad words that she had been forced to swallow over a century of conformity. "Shit!" she shouted. Amaranta, who was starting to put the clothes into the trunk, thought that she had been bitten by a scorpion. "Where is it?" she asked in alarm. "What? The bug?" Amaranta said. Ursula put a finger on her heart. "Here," she said. On Thursday, at 2 in the afternoon, José Arcadio left for the seminary. Ursula would remember him always as she said goodbye to him, languid and serious, without shedding a tear, as she had taught him, sweltering in the heat in the green corduroy suit with copper buttons and a starched bow around his neck. He left the dining room impregnated with the penetrating fragrance of rose water that she had sprinkled on his head so that she could follow his tracks through the house. While the farewell lunch was going on, the family concealed its nervousness with festive expressions, and they celebrated with exaggerated enthusiasm the remarks that Father Antonio Isabel made. But when they took out the trunk, bound in velvet and with silver corners, it was as if they had taken a coffin out of the house. The only one who refused to take part in the farewell was Colonel Aureliano Buendia. "That's all we need," he muttered. "A pope." 3 months later, Aureliano II and Fernanda took Meme to school and came back with a clavichord, which took the place of the pianola. It was around that time that Amaranta started sewing her own shroud. The banana fever had calmed down. The old inhabitants of Macondo found themselves surrounded by newcomers, and working hard to cling to their precarious resources of times gone by, but comforted in any case by the sense that they had survived a shipwreck. In the house, they still had guests for lunch, and the old routine was never really set up again until the banana company left years later. Nevertheless, there were radical changes in the traditional sense of hospitality, because at that time it was Fernanda who imposed her rules. With Ursula relegated to the shadows and with Amaranta absorbed in the work of her winding cloth, the former apprentice queen had the freedom to choose the guests and impose on them the rigid norms that her parents had taught her. Her severity made the house a redoubt of old customs in a town convulsed by the vulgarity with which the outsiders squandered their easy fortunes. For her, with no further questions asked, proper people were those who had nothing to do with the banana company. Even José Arcadio II, her brother-in-law, was the victim of her discriminatory jealousy, because during the excitement of the first days, he gave up his stupendous fighting cocks again and took a job as foreman with the banana company. "He won't ever come into this house again," Fernanda said, "as long as he carries the rash of the foreigners." Such was the narrowness imposed in the house that Aureliano II felt more comfortable at Petrokotis's. First, with the pretext of taking the burden off his wife, he transferred his parties. Then, with the pretext that the animals were losing their fertility, he transferred his barns and stables. Finally, with the pretext that it was cooler in his concubine's house, he transferred the small office in which he handled his business. When Fernanda realized that she was a widow, whose husband had still not died, it was already too late for things to return to their former state. Aureliano II barely ate at home, and the only appearances he put in, such as to sleep with his wife, were not enough to convince anyone. One night, out of carelessness, morning found him in Petrokotis's bed. Fernanda, contrary to expectations, did not reproach him in the least or give the slightest sigh of resentment, but on the same day she sent two trunks with his clothing to the house of his concubine. She sent them in broad daylight, and with instructions that they be carried through the middle of the street, so that everyone could see them, thinking that her straying husband would be unable to bear the shame, and would return to the fold with his head hung low. But that heroic gesture was just one more proof of how poorly Fernanda knew not only the character of her husband, but the character of a community that had nothing to do with that of her parents. For everyone who saw the trunks pass by said that it was the natural culmination of a story whose intimacies were known to everyone, and Aureliano II celebrated the freedom he had received with a party that lasted for 3 days. To the greater disadvantage of his wife, as she was entering into a sad maturity, with her somber long dresses, her old-fashioned medals, and her out-of-place pride, the concubine seemed to be bursting with a second youth, clothed in gaudy dresses of natural silk, and with her eyes tiger-striped with a glow of vindication. Aureliano II gave himself over to her again with the fury of adolescence, as before, when Petrokotis had not loved him for himself, but because she had him mixed up with his twin brother, and as she slept with both of them at the same time, she thought that God had given her the good fortune of having a man who could make love like two. The restored passion was so pressing that on more than one occasion they would look each other in the eyes as they were getting ready to eat, and without saying anything, they would cover their plates and go into the bedroom, dying of hunger and of love. Inspired by the things he had seen on his furtive visits to the French matrons, Aureliano II bought Petrokotis a bed with an archiepiscopal canopy, put velvet curtains on the windows, and covered the ceiling and the walls of the bedroom with large rock crystal mirrors. At the same time, he was more of a carouser and spendthrift than ever. On the train, which arrived every day at 11 o'clock, he would receive cases and more cases of champagne and brandy. On the way back from the station, he would drag the improvised cumbiamba along in full view of all the people on the way, natives or outsiders, acquaintances or people yet to be known, without distinctions of any kind. Even the slippery Mr. Brown, who talked only in a strange tongue, let himself be seduced by the tempting signs that Aureliano II made him, and several times he got dead drunk in Petrokotis's house, and he even made the fierce German shepherd dogs that went everywhere with him dance to some Texas songs that he himself mumbled in one way or another to the accompaniment of the accordion. "Cease, cows!" Aureliano II shouted at the height of the party. "Cease, because life is short." He never looked better, nor had he been loved more, nor had the breeding of his animals been wilder. There was a slaughtering of so many cows, pigs, and chickens for the endless parties, that the ground in the courtyard turned black and muddy with so much blood. It was an eternal execution ground of bones and innards, a mud pit of leftovers, and they had to keep exploding dynamite bombs all the time, so that the buzzards would not pluck out the guests' eyes. Aureliano II grew fat, purple-colored, turtle-shaped, because of an appetite comparable only to that of José Arcadio, when he came back from travelling around the world. The prestige of his outlandish veracity, of his immense capacity as a spendthrift, of his unprecedented hospitality, went beyond the borders of the swamp and attracted the best qualified gluttons from all along the coast. Fabulous eaters arrived from everywhere to take part in the irrational tourneys of capacity and resistance that were organized in the house of Petra Kotes. Aureliano Segundo was the unconquered eater until the luckless Saturday when Camila Sagastume appeared, a totemic female known all through the land by the good name of the Elephant. The duel lasted until dawn on Tuesday. During the first 24 hours, having dispatched a dinner of veal with cassava, yams, and fried bananas, and a case and a half of champagne in addition, Aureliano Segundo was sure of victory. He seemed more enthusiastic, more vital than his imperturbable adversary, who possessed a style that was obviously more professional, but at the same time less emotional for the large crowd that filled the house. While Aureliano Segundo ate with great bites, overcome by the anxiety of victory, the Elephant was slicing her meat with the art of a surgeon, and eating it unhurriedly, and even with a certain pleasure. She was gigantic and sturdy, but over her colossal form, a tenderness of femininity prevailed, and she had a face that was so beautiful, hands so fine and well cared for, and such an irresistible personal charm, that when Aureliano Segundo saw her enter the house, he commented in a low voice that he would have preferred to have the tourney in bed and not at the table. Later on, when he saw her consume a side of veal without breaking a single rule of good table manners, he commented seriously that that delicate, fascinating, and insatiable proboscidean was in a certain way the ideal woman. He was not mistaken. The reputation of a bone-crusher that had preceded the Elephant had no basis. She was not a beef-cruncher or a bearded lady from a Greek circus, as had been said, but the director of a school of voice. She had learned to eat when she was already the respectable mother of a family, looking for a way for her children to eat better, and not by means of any artificial stimulation of their appetites, but through the absolute tranquility of their spirits. Her theory, demonstrated in practice, was based on the principle that a person who had all matters of conscience in perfect shape should be able to eat until overcome by fatigue. And it was for moral reasons and sporting interest that she left her school and her home to compete with a man whose fame as a great, unprincipled eater had spread throughout the country. From the first moment she saw him, she saw that Aureliano Segundo would lose not his stomach, but his character. At the end of the first night, while the Elephant was boldly going on, Aureliano Segundo was wearing himself out with a great deal of talking and laughing. They slept 4 hours. On awakening, each one had the juice of 40 oranges, 8 quarts of coffee, and 30 raw eggs. On the second morning, after many hours without sleep and having put away 2 pigs, a bunch of bananas, and 4 cases of champagne, the Elephant suspected that Aureliano Segundo had unknowingly discovered the same method as hers, but by the absurd route of total irresponsibility. He was, therefore, more dangerous than she had thought. Nevertheless, when Petra Kotes brought 2 roast turkeys to the table, Aureliano Segundo was a step away from being stuffed. "If you can't, don't eat any more," the Elephant said to him. "Let's call it a tie." She said it from her heart, understanding that she could not eat another mouthful either, out of remorse for bringing on the death of her adversary. But Aureliano Segundo interpreted it as another challenge, and he filled himself with turkey beyond his incredible capacity. He lost consciousness. He fell face down into the plate filled with bones, frothing at the mouth like a dog, and drowning in moans of agony. He felt, in the midst of the darkness, that they were throwing him from the top of a tower into a bottomless pit, and in a last flash of consciousness, he realized that at the end of that endless fall, death was waiting for him. "Take me to Fernanda," he managed to say. His friends left him at the house thinking that they had helped him fulfill his promise to his wife not to die in his concubine's bed. Petra Kotes had shined his patent leather boots that he wanted to wear in his coffin, and she was already looking for someone to take them when they came to tell her that Aureliano Segundo was out of danger. He did recover, indeed, in less than a week, and 2 weeks later he was celebrating the fact of his survival with unprecedented festivities. He continued living at Petra Kotes's, but he would visit Fernanda every day, and sometimes he would stay to eat with the family, as if fate had reversed the situation and had made him the husband of his concubine and the lover of his wife. It was a rest for Fernanda. During the boredom of her abandonment, her only distractions were the clavichord lessons at siesta time and the letters from her children. In the detailed messages that she sent them every 2 weeks, there was not a single line of truth. She hid her troubles from them. She hid them from the sadness of a house which, in spite of the light on the begonias, in spite of the heaviness at 2 in the afternoon, in spite of the frequent waves of festivals that came in from the street, was more and more like the colonial mansion of her parents. Fernando would wander alone among the 3 living ghosts and the dead ghost of José Arcadio Buendía, who at times would come to sit down with an inquisitive attention in the half-light of the parlour while she was playing the clavichord. Colonel Aureliano Buendía was a shadow. Since the last time that he had gone out into the street to propose a war without any future to Colonel Gerineldo Márquez, he left the workshop only to urinate under the chestnut tree. He did not receive any visits, except that of the barber every 3 weeks. He fed on anything that Ursula brought him once a day, and even though he kept on making little gold fishes with the same passion as before, he stopped selling them when he found out that people were buying them not as pieces of jewelry, but as historic relics. He made a bonfire in the courtyard of the dolls of Remedios, which had decorated their bedroom since their wedding. The watchful Ursula realized what her son was doing, but she could not stop him. "You have a heart of stone," she told him. "It's not a question of a heart," he said. "The room's getting full of moths." Amaranta was weaving her shroud. Fernanda did not understand why she would write occasional letters to Meme and even send her gifts, and, on the other hand, did not even want to hear about José Arcadio. "They'll die without knowing why," Amaranta answered when she was asked through Ursula, and that answer planted an enigma in Fernanda's heart that she was never able to clarify. Tall, broad-shouldered, proud, always dressed in abundant petticoats, with lace and an air of distinction that resisted the years and bad memories, Amaranta seemed to carry the cross of ashes of virginity on her forehead. In reality, she carried it on her hand in the black bandage, which she did not take off even to sleep, and which she washed and ironed herself. Her life was spent in weaving her shroud. It might have been said that she wove during the day and unwove during the night, and not with any hope of defeating solitude in that way, but, quite the contrary, in order to nurture it. The greatest worry that Fernanda had during her years of abandonment was that Meme would come to spend her first vacation and not find Aureliano Secundo at home. His congestion had put an end to that fear. When Meme returned, her parents had made an agreement that not only would the girl think that Aureliano Secundo was still a domesticated husband, but also that she would not notice the sadness of the house. Every year, for 2 months, Aureliano Secundo played his role of an exemplary husband, and he organized parties with ice cream and cookies, which the gay and lively schoolgirl enhanced with the clavichord. It was obvious from then on that she had inherited very little of her mother's character. She seemed more of a second version of Amaranta, when the latter had not known bitterness, and was arousing the house with her dance steps at the age of 12 or 14, before her secret passion for Pietro Crespi was to twist the direction of her heart in the end. But unlike Amaranta, unlike all of them, Meme still did not reveal the solitary fate of the family, and she seemed entirely in conformity with the world. Even when she would shut herself up in the parlour at 2 in the afternoon to practice the clavichord with an inflexible discipline, it was obvious that she liked the house, that she spent the whole year dreaming about the excitement of the young people her arrival brought around, and that she was not far removed from the festive vocation and hospitable excesses of her father. The first sign of that calamitous inheritance was revealed on her 3rd vacation, when Mamie appeared at the house with 4 nuns and 68 classmates, whom she had invited to spend a week with her family on her own initiative and without any previous warning. "How awful," Fernanda lamented. "This child is as much of a barbarian as her father." It was necessary to borrow beds and hammocks from the neighbours, to set up 9 shifts at the table, to fix ours for bathing, and to borrow 40 stools, so that the girls in blue uniforms, with masculine buttons, would not spend the whole day running from one place to another. The visit was a failure because the noisy schoolgirls would scarcely finish breakfast before they had to start taking turns for lunch and then for dinner, and for the whole week they were able to take only one walk through the plantations. At nightfall, the nuns were exhausted, unable to move, give another order, and still the troop of tireless adolescents was in the courtyard, singing school songs out of tune. One day they were on the point of trampling Ursula, who made an effort to be useful, precisely where she was most in the way. On another day the nuns got all excited because Colonel Aureliano Buendia had urinated under the chestnut tree without being concerned that the schoolgirls were in the courtyard. Amaranta was on the point of causing panic because one of the nuns went into the kitchen as she was salting the soup, and the only thing that occurred to her to say was to ask what those handfuls of white powder were. "Arsenic," Amaranta answered. The night of their arrival the students carried on in such a way, trying to go to the bathroom before they went to bed, that at 1 o'clock in the morning the last ones were still going in. Fernanda then bought 72 chamber pots, but she only managed to change the nocturnal problem into a morning one, because from dawn on there was a long line of girls, each with her pot in her hand, waiting for her turn to wash it. Although some of them suffered fevers, and several of them were infected by mosquito bites, most of them showed an unbreakable resistance as they faced the most troublesome difficulties, and even at the time of the greatest heat they would scamper through the garden. When they finally left, the flowers were destroyed, the furniture broken, and the walls covered with drawings and writing, but Fernanda pardoned them for all of the damage because of her relief at their leaving. She returned the borrowed beds and stools, and kept the 72 chamber pots in Melquiades' room. The locked room, about which the spiritual life of the house revolved in former times, was known from that time on as the chamber pot room. For Colonel Aureliano Buendia, it was the most appropriate name, because while the rest of the family were still amazed by the fact that Melquiades' room was immune to dust and destruction, he saw it turned into a dunghill. In any case, it did not seem to bother him who was correct, and if he found out about the fate of the room, it was because Fernanda kept passing by and disturbing his work for a whole afternoon as she put away the chamber pots. During those days, José Arcadio Secundo reappeared in the house. He went along the porch without greeting anyone, and he shut himself up in the workshop to talk to the colonel. In spite of the fact that she could not see him, Ursula analyzed the clicking of his foreman's boots and was surprised at the unbridgeable distance that separated him from the family, even from the twin brother with whom he had played ingenious games of confusion in childhood, and with whom he no longer had any traits in common. He was linear, solemn, and had a pensive air and the sadness of a Saracen, and a mournful glow on his face that was the colour of autumn. He was the one who most resembled his mother, Santa Sofia de la Piedad. Ursula reproached herself for the habit of forgetting about him when she spoke about the family, but when she sensed him in the house again, and noticed that the colonel let him into the workshop during work hours, she re-examined her old memories and confirmed the belief that, at some moment in childhood, he had changed places with his twin brother, because it was he, and not the other one, who should have been called Aureliano. No one knew the details of his life. At one time it was discovered that he had no fixed abode, that he raised fighting cocks at Pilar Ternera's house, and that sometimes he would stay there to sleep, but that he almost always spent the night in the rooms of the French matrons. He drifted about, with no ties of affection, with no ambitions, like a wandering star in Ursula's planetary system. In reality, José Arcadio Secundo was not a member of the family, nor would he ever be of any other, since that distant dawn, when Colonel Hernando Marquez took him to the barracks, not so that he could see an execution, but so that, for the rest of his life, he would never forget the sad and somewhat mocking smile of the man being shot. That was not only his oldest memory, but the only one he had of his childhood. The other one, that of an old man with an old-fashioned vest and a hat with a brim like a crow's wings, who told him marvelous things framed in a dazzling window, he was unable to place in any period. It was an uncertain memory, entirely devoid of lessons or nostalgia, the opposite of the memory of the executed man, which had really set the direction of his life and would return to his memory clearer and clearer as he grew older, as if the passage of time were bringing him closer to it. Ursula tried to use José Arcadio Secundo to get Colonel Aureliano Buendía to give up his imprisonment.
"Get him to go to the movies," she said to him. "Even if he doesn't like the picture, at least he'll breathe a little fresh air."
But it did not take her long to realize that he was as insensible to her begging as the colonel would have been, and that they were armored by the same impermeability of affection. Although she never knew, nor did anyone know, what they spoke about in their prolonged sessions, shut up in the workshop, she understood that they were probably the only members of the family who seemed drawn together by some affinity. The truth is that not even José Arcadio Secundo would have been able to draw the colonel out of his confinement. The invasion of the schoolgirls had lowered the limits of his patience. With the pretext that his wedding bedroom was at the mercy of the moths, in spite of the destruction of Remedios' appetizing dolls, he hung a hammock in the workshop, and then he would leave it only to go into the courtyard to take care of his necessities. Ursula was unable to string together even a trivial conversation with him. She knew that he did not look at the dishes of food, but would put them at one end of his workbench while he finished a little fish, and it did not matter to him if the soup curdled or if the meat got cold. He grew harder and harder ever since Colonel Hernaldo Marquez refused to back him up in a senile war. He locked himself up inside himself, and the family finally thought of him as if he were dead. No other human reaction was seen in him until 1 October 11th, when he went to the street door to watch a circus parade. For Colonel Aureliano Buendía, it had been a day just like all of those of his last years. At 5 o'clock in the morning, the noise of the toads and crickets outside the wall woke him up. The drizzle had persisted since Saturday, and there was no necessity for him to hear their tiny whispering among the leaves of the garden, because he would have felt the cold in his bones in any case. He was, as always, wrapped in his woolen blanket and wearing his crude cotton long drawers, which he still wore for comfort, even though, because of their musty old-fashioned style, he called them his goth drawers. He put on his tight pants, but did not button them up, nor did he put the gold button into his shirt collar as he always did, because he planned to take a bath. Then he put the blanket over his head like a cowl, brushed his dripping mustache with his fingers, and went to urinate in the courtyard. There was still so much time left for the sun to come out that José Arcadio Buendía was still dozing under the shelter of palm fronds that had been rotted by the rain. He did not see him, as he had never seen him, nor did he hear the incomprehensible phrase that the ghost of his father addressed to him as he awakened, startled by the stream of hot urine that splattered his shoes. He put the bath off for later, not because of the cold and the dampness, but because of the oppressive October mist. On his way back to the workshop, he noticed the odor of the wick that Santa Sofia de la Piedad was using to light the stoves, and he waited in the kitchen for the coffee to boil, so that he could take along his mug without sugar. Santa Sofia de la Piedad asked him, as on every morning, what day of the week it was, and he answered that it was Tuesday, October 11th. Watching the glow of the fire, as it gilded the persistent woman, who neither then nor in any instant of her life seemed to exist completely, he suddenly remembered that on 1 October 11th, in the middle of the war, he had awakened with the brutal certainty that the woman with whom he had slept was dead. She really was, and he could not forget the date, because she had asked him an hour before what day it was. In spite of the memory, he did not have an awareness, this time either, of to what degree his omens had abandoned him, and while the coffee was boiling, he kept on thinking out of pure curiosity, but without the slightest risk of nostalgia, about the woman whose name he had never known, and whose face he had not seen, because she had stumbled to his hammock in the dark. Nevertheless, in the emptiness of so many women who came into his life in the same way, he did not remember that she was the one who, in the delirium of that first meeting, was on the point of foundering in her own tears, and scarcely an hour before her death, had sworn to love him until she died. He did not think about her again, or about any of the others after he went into the workshop with the steaming cup, and he lighted the lamp in order to count the little gold fishes, which he kept in a tin pail. There were 17 of them. Since he had decided not to sell any, he kept on making 2 fishes a day, and when he finished 25, he would melt them down and start all over again. He worked all morning, absorbed, without thinking about anything, without realizing